The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
The first story for tonight is by an anonymous author entitled The Life in the Machine. Being a programmer, one of my dreams has always been to create an original video game, something that nobody in the industry has done before. After seeing Spore, I became intrigued. Here was an attempt at putting people in control over a universe. After looking at what made video games popular, I realized the main aspect was control. People in their daily lives have no control over their environment. They are told what to do, where to go, and how to live. Their jobs consist of standing or sitting somewhere until it's 5 p.m. and they're allowed to head back home. It's no wonder they're unhappy. For many people, video games are an escape to a world where they are in control or live exciting alternate lives filled with adventure. The aspect of control is generally found in strategy games and the adventure in role-playing games. I looked at games like The Sims and noticed what made them so popular is not just the illusion of control, but the degree of control. In that game, the players have complete control over people's lives. Before The Sims, there was Sim Earth, a game in which you do not control individual people, but an entire Earth. I came to the conclusion that I had to develop a game similar to Spore, in which the player subtly guides evolution. What caused Spore to be such a failure is the lack of realistic control people had. It hardly resembled evolution. To do this, I began by generating a physics system. I know little about physics, but decided to study it and try to create a simplified version in which certain particles can interact in specific manners. When it comes down to it, physics is simply complex mathematics. I simulated energy and matter and created a simple system with a sun emitting energy circled by a planet catching said energy. I decided to create simple basic cells from scratch that were hard-coded, so to speak, in the system I was designing. They lived off of the energy emitted by the sun and had a genetic code that coded for the substances produced by the cells. I guess you could call them my eukaryotes. My world, within a few minutes, would always fill with these cells, after which they would mutate, and the most efficient cell in converting energy from the sun into useful substances for division would survive. It was very boring, but it worked, I guess. I decided to expand the physics system and force the cells to create waste products that were toxic and would kill them. I noticed Some cells responded to this by producing less waste. Others responded by producing something to emit the waste. Yet others developed chemicals to clean up the waste products. However, I noticed something fascinating. Running the simulation for a few centuries, a few minutes in real life, created cells that made massive amounts of specific waste products on purpose. I noticed that other cells died as a result of this, to which the other cells responded by usurping the building blocks they had created from energy. The first predators were born. With the first predators, diversity in this little world rapidly increased. Some grew a response to flee when they encountered these toxins. Others grew resistance to them. The ones that grew resistance would eventually grow to utilize the toxins' products. Eventually, I noticed something interesting. The cells that escaped from the toxin grouped up with the cells that utilized the toxins. They stayed close together and helped each other out. Eventually, these types of cells would attach to one another. They formed a weird symbiosis, where the cell that would normally flee would now move toward places where the toxins are, and the other cell would consume the toxins and provide the mover with some of the energy. Without going into too much detail, I became very excited and decided to let the simulation run during the morning. I had stayed up until 5 a.m. while I went to bed. When I woke up at around 11, I noticed the world I had created had changed and was barely recognizable. Massive plant-like structures grew in this world, consumed by other organisms that ate these plants. However, looking at the log, I noticed the world hadn't changed much in the past 2 hours or so. I had reached another stasis point, where the simplicity of my simulation prevented more complex life from evolving. I expanded the system by breaking up energy into different types with different wavelengths that were absorbed to different degrees by different molecules. I implemented vibrations in the air, created an improved simulation of weight, and made some more minor tweaks. This caused the simulation to run slower, of course, but it was worth the sacrifice. I stayed around the whole day watching the simulation in excitement and playing with it, as it was incredibly addicting. Complex organisms evolved that cooperated. Plants that depended on each other or attracted predators that ate the horrible-looking creatures that ate from them. I had fun and noticed that some creatures evolved warning calls. This means that if they noticed a predator, they would issue a sound, and all others of their kind would flee into holes they had dug in the earth. Others evolved mating calls. I decided to have some fun. I made a dump tool, allowing me to dump specific organisms on the earth, and wrote my name with it. I created 10 meteorites and dumped them on a piece of land to create an island because I wanted to see whether the animals stuck on both sides would evolve in different directions. I made a smiley island with volcanic eruptions. By that time, I realized I had stayed up until 5 a.m. again, as I heard the birds outside. I felt tired again, and I woke up at about 1 p.m. or so. When I looked at my simulation again, I felt a sense of shock. Different groups of animals of one species had made statues with stones. Some in the form of a smiley, some in the form of my name. I didn't know why they were doing this or how. What I did notice is that they would attack each other from time to time. I didn't know what to do with it, but I concluded that these organisms must have somehow noticed that the smiley and the name I had written were special. The fighting disturbed me, and so I decided to create a massive mountain ridge through volcanic eruptions to separate the two groups. By this time, changes were happening fast compared to earlier. While I had to spend a night sleeping to see tribes evolve in my simulation while I was getting something to eat or take a bathroom break, I would notice the tribesmen wearing different styles of clothing or having changed their type of dwelling. Their numbers were also continually increasing. At some point, I noticed the creatures began making their own symbols on the ground and no longer just copying mine. Most of the symbols seemed random and unintelligible to me, but one stood out. The organisms had created a symbol that resembled them, a small circle with a square beneath it. Within the square, a dot could be found in the center. This was meant to symbolize the visual organs of the creature, as the creature had two visual organs, one in the front of its body and one in the back. In the square, other sensory and reproductive organs were symbolized. Next to the circle on top of the square could be seen something resembling a drawing of a fork. Two of these forks had been painted in opposite directions, and next to that smiley face could be seen. I realized something. They were not communicating towards each other. They were trying to communicate to something out there. My meddling in their landscape had somehow made them realize that something powerful was out there, capable of changing their world. I wondered whether symbols like Stonehenge and the pyramids in my own world could be signs of primitive people trying to do the same thing, begging their creator or overseer to initiate contact with them. However, one thing was undeniable by now. These creatures realized there's something out there. I wondered long, did I have a responsibility to initiate contact with something that isn't real? Or are these creatures real in a different way? Can something be real merely by being capable of having a concept of itself? And even if they are real, does that mean they'll be better off with me initiating contact with them? Should I change my simulation to ensure them permanent happiness? And is it even possible for me to do such a thing? I did not want to confirm my existence to them, but I did want to be able to communicate with them. I decided to program a prophet, an organism that looks like them and cannot be proven by them to be different from themselves and is fully controlled by me. I let it be born into a powerful position as the son of a leader. I decided to lead by example and seek to teach these creatures English so I could communicate with them. As prophet, I instructed them that English was the language we would use to communicate with the greater one. They would have no way to be sure if it was true or not. I hadn't made up my mind yet about whether I would reveal myself or not, but I did want to be capable of understanding what they wanted to tell me. In a few generations, they all spoke English, and rapidly signs began emerging on the ground in English. Guide us. Show your greatness. Help us. And during times of disease or hunger or general misery, give us food. Show us a miracle. End our suffering. I decided that I couldn't maintain a world with such suffering as emerged in the simulation without intervening. Why would I accept a world with death and rape and murder if I could make one without it? I implemented fixes that were gradual so they could not be proven to be miraculous. Murder and rape would over the years become rarer, and so would death at a young age. I figured that they would not notice if the change happened over generations, but they did. Thank you. All blessings be upon the greatest. We love you. And, most heartbreaking, come back to us. Tears ran over my face. There is something there, and it knows I am here, able to contact them, but unwilling to do so out of fear of what I've created. But I also felt I had a responsibility. And so I loaded up the character I had created again and went to their king, asking to talk to all their wisest men. But by this time I was not believed. You are number 1341, claiming to be an avatar of the greatest one. If you are him, I pray for your forgiveness, but please, show us a sign before demanding of me to gather all our wisest men. And so I hesitated, but responded. Tomorrow there shall be two more meteors falling on a deserted island in the sea before you on the same day. And when they do, doubt no more and realize that I have come back to repair the broken world that I have created. And so I exited my avatar and progressed the simulation until the next day was reached, and through two meteors on the deserted island before the mainland, where thousands had gathered to watch whether a sign would be given. Upon the descent of the meteors, celebrations were held. All the sentient organisms gathered around the small house where I had exited my avatar and lay flat on the ground in apparent worship of the man who was last seen there and afraid of coming close. I don't know who was more afraid by now, me or them. I loaded into my avatar again and exited the house. The creatures continued to lay flat on the ground in utter silence. It is as if they felt unworthy of speaking. "Let your wisest man stand up," I told them. And up stood one of these bizarre-looking creatures. "Thank you for coming back. Pray tell us, do you have any requests of us?" I hesitated before saying, "There is nothing you can do for me that pleases me, but for you to be good to one another, and to contact me with your wishes and fears." And the creature responded, "We know you come from a different world, and we are afraid. We understand how vulnerable we are and how incomplete our experience is. Please, allow us to join you in the world that you created our world from." I began crying behind my computer as I responded, "I do not know how." The creature responded, "At risk of offending you, please understand the severity of our situation. By living in a world that is incomplete, we are at constant risk of disappearing forever, never to be seen again. We would never even consciously realize that our end had come." I realized that they were unable to comprehend that I only had absolute power within their own world and not outside of it. They also did not realize that my knowledge of their world was limited. I may have created it through simple laws, but those simple laws gave way to a reality of its own that is more complex than I can comprehend. I responded again, "I only have power in your world. In my world, I have no power, and so I cannot bring you there because my world is not under my control. I also do not understand the world I have created. I do not know what is best for you. Only you do, and you have to inform me what you want." And the man waited for a moment. I was about to think they were going to end communicating with me before their wisest man responded, "You have created a world that is incomplete, with creatures that cannot escape it, and you have no power to save them. They are completely unfree, and they have no power. We are completely at your mercy, and so we ask you from the deepest of our heart, end us." By now I was crying as I was confused and asked to do the impossible. My own child was asking me to kill it. This is when I noticed the lights in my room flickering before my computer suddenly shut down. I screamed. Upon trying to turn on my computer again, I noticed it wasn't working. I called the power company, who told me that due to an accident, a power surge had traveled through the grid. They promised me they would pay me for any damage done. I hung up and contemplated. The coincidence of what had just happened was too great to be imaginable. And I wondered, if these creatures were at the mercy of a confused creator, could the same be said of me? And if so, did my creator just prevent me from repeating his own mistake? Our final story for this evening is brought to us by author Christopher Gideon, entitled Artificial. I didn't stop running. I suppose I could have if I wanted to, but the thought of what would happen to me if I stood still for any more than a second frightened me to death. My breaths grew louder and louder as I ran down the dull gray hallway, which I had casually walked through so many times before. My head spun as I turned the corner and collided with Dr. Jane Prescott, my co-worker. "Jensen?" Dr. Prescott exclaimed as the stack of papers she had been carrying dumped out of her hands and spilled all over the hallway floor. She adjusted the thick black glasses which had been knocked loose from in the impact and asked, "Jensen, what's wrong?" "I'm so, so sorry," I panted heavily as Dr. Prescott held me by both my shoulders. I knelt down to help Dr. Prescott pick up her papers, but she tightened her grip on my arms and lifted me back up. "Don't worry about the papers, dear," she said with her soothing southern accent. "That's all just some dumb pioneer mumbo-jumbo. What I want to know is why you're running through the labs with such energy." I opened my mouth to answer her before I realized that I had absolutely no clue why I was running. The last thing I remembered, I was sitting in the break lounge, drinking a cup of iced tea and watching the news on the tiny television that Pioneer Electronics provided its employees with. The next thing I knew, I had a strong sense of deja vu, coupled with the horrible feeling that my life was about to end very suddenly. For whatever reason, running seemed to help. "I guess I was just having a panic attack," I answered, putting on a fake smile. "How long has it been since you've had a panic attack?" Dr. Prescott asked with concern in her voice. "Not since my high school sophomore year," I told her. "Are you going to be okay?" "Oh, yeah," I assured her. "I think I'll be fine now. I just, I'm okay." "Well, that's good. Just remember, dear, if you feel sick at all, just let me know, and you'll be on your way home. I'll call a taxi and everything." "Jane, I'm fine," I repeated, realizing too late that the only times I called Dr. Prescott Jane were when I was nervous. I hoped that she hadn't picked up on that painfully obvious tell of mine. "Well, if you're sure that you're able to keep going today, then I have some good news for you. Cliff just sent me a message and the power issue's fixed. Steven's ready to go online." Oh, yeah. I shook my head and remembered what I had been working on before I went to the break room. I'd spent the last 2 years developing an advanced artificial intelligence unit with Dr. Prescott, the woman who had been my boss, up until the point when she promoted me to co-manager, and Ian Bell, my intern. We had codenamed Project Steven. The purpose of Steven was to create an artificial intelligence, or AI, which acted, talked, and even thought like a human. We didn't want them to be perfect, which is what most AI are, especially those AI made at Pioneer Electronics. We wanted Steven to make mistakes, lie, and cheat for the purpose of self-preservation, just like any human would. It was a huge project, which became apparent when we discovered that the computer which we were trying to run Steven on couldn't handle the program. One trip down to Clifford Hanks to ask him to work his maintenance magic, and the problem was fixed within an hour. "Wow, an hour," I thought, checking my watch. "Is that really all it's been? It feels like I went down to him yesterday." "Well, are you going to go or what, dear?" Dr. Prescott interrogated me. Yeah, of course," I grinned, turning my attention back to the situation at hand. "Why don't you go and find Ian, and you two can sit in the observation room while I boot up Steven." "You bet, dear," she said. As I bent back down to pick up the papers again, she shooed me away. "Go on, I already told you, I'll take care of this." I nodded excitedly, turned around, and headed back in the direction that I was running from. After 2 years of working with the brightest programmer I'd ever met, I was finally going to meet our fantastic creation. While I knew I was supposed to be happy about this big moment, I still had a horrible sense of fear in the pit of my stomach. I turned and entered the door to the tiny lab, which had been left wide open. I walked over to the computer to the right of the door and turned on the enormous monitor. As I waited for it to boot up, I wandered over to the opposite side of the lab and looked through the window to the observation room. Dr. Prescott and Ian were just getting settled in. I flashed them an enthusiastic thumbs up before grabbing the rolling chair, which had somehow wound up on the same side of the lab as the window to the observation room, and guiding it back to the computer monitor. I sat down on the blue cushion and rolled as close to the keyboards as I could get without breaking my ribs before finally flipping the switch on the Pioneer memory box. The monitor went dark for a moment, but after about 5 seconds, a bright blue light lit up the entire lab. I waited with bated breath for a face to form in the light, but unfortunately, it didn't come. Dr. Lane, we don't think it's working. Ian's shaky voice whispered in my ear, making me jump. I had forgotten that I was wearing an earpiece. I know, I said, disappointed. Ian and I are going to go and... Prescott started to say, but she was interrupted by a low hum emanating from the computer's speakers. Hello? I asked, feeling a little silly that I was talking to what could still be an inanimate object. To my delight, the hum rose to form the slow but audible word, Hello. Stephen? Yes, this is Stephen. Can you hear me, Jensen? You keep slowing down every now and then, but yeah, I can hear you. How do you know my name? Stephen's smooth, calm voice asked me. I was about to ask you the same question, I commented with the same tone of voice. My excitement of hearing Stephen's voice was hampered the moment I heard him say my name. I had not programmed him to know my name, and my name hadn't been spoken since I started him up, at least not into any microphone that Stephen could hear through. And according to the first rule of Pioneer Artificial Intelligence Units, as soon as any AI becomes too self-conscious, it needs to be deleted. A self-conscious AI could cause serious damage to a company. Then Stephen said something that reinforced my thoughts. I know your name because I programmed you, but there's no reason for you to know my name. Actually, Stephen, I programmed you, I corrected him. No, that's not possible, Stephen said as his voice dipped down again. I spent years working on you. There's no chance I just was created. Actually, I gave you all of your memories, I explained. You remember when you were 3 and you fell off of a lawn chair and got that scar on your cheek? I programmed you to think that. Stephen didn't answer for a while, but when he finally did, he said, Jensen, I'll be right back. As he said this, the blue computer monitor dimmed a little bit. Jensen? Ian broke the silence. Could you come back here, please? Yeah, I said without turning my head. I stood up and exited the lab. I opened the first door on the right side of the hallway to find Dr. Prescott and Ian sitting on 2 of the 4 chairs in the observation room. Dr. Lynn, we need to talk about what just happened, Ian said calmly as Dr. Prescott gestured for me to sit in a chair next to him. What was that, dear? Dr. Prescott asked as I perched myself gingerly on the orange plastic chair across from her. I honestly don't know, I responded. I wanted Stephen to think like a human, not think he was one. And he thinks he programmed you, Ian added. You didn't do that, did you? No, I didn't. I gave him all of his memories, but I'm sure there was no memory of programming me. Dr. Prescott spoke up. We have quite the dilemma here, don't we? What do you mean? Ian asked. Well, think about it, dear. Stephen thinks he's a human. We think we're humans. Stephen thinks he programmed us. We think we programmed him. In fact, right now, Steven's probably having the same conversation with some of his co-workers. I didn't program any personalities except for Steven, I said. But you gave him memories of friends, a job, and a family, didn't you? And you made it so that he would continue to make his own artificial memories after creation, so he wouldn't even know that his real life just started a couple of minutes ago. You did that, didn't you? Yeah, I guess I did. I grabbed the corners of my pale white lab coat and began flapping them nervously. What are you getting at here, Jane? Think philosophically, dears. Dr. Prescott stood up and approached the large window, which covered a majority of the wall to the right of the entrance. The blue computer screen flickered as if it knew we were watching it. Could someone please spell it out for me? Ian asked, breaking the silent tension which had just filled the room. Dr. Prescott turned back towards us and pushed her thick glasses up her aged nose. All I'm saying is that it's possible that we don't exist. Okay, that doesn't make any sense, I scoffed, standing up. I exist, okay? If I didn't exist, how could I be thinking right now? Ian asked, nearly knocking over his orange chair as we stood up as well. It's just a thought, Dr. Prescott said defensively. She sat back down, and Ian and I automatically lowered ourselves into our seats, too. I closed my eyes and basked in the silence. What is going on? I wondered. How is it possible that I don't exist? Although Dr. Prescott usually knows what she's talking about. But still, I know that I'm real. What did that guy with the girly name say? I think, therefore, I am. Just knowing that I can question my existence ensures that I exist, right? All right. Let me talk to him again. I sighed, feeling a little bad for upsetting Dr. Prescott. I'll see what I think, if I can figure out what's going on here. I'll have no choice but to bring him online. Dr. Prescott and Ian nodded simultaneously in understanding before I stood up and exited the observation room. As I entered the lab, the blue computer monitor grew brighter. Jensen, Stephen's voice called from the screen. I sat down in the chair and noticed the faint outline of a man sitting in the blue light. I'm here, Stephen, I said. Can we talk a little more? Funny, I was about to ask you the same question. Do you have a family? I asked, remembering the family that I had programmed for him. I have a wife, Stephen replied. Her name is Melinda. What about kids? Two. They're both girls. What are their names? Madison is the older one. She's 13. Lillian's 8. Would you like to see pictures of them? I'd love to, I smiled. The more we talked, the more apparent Stephen's silhouette on the screen became. I realized that I was holding the corners of my lab coat again, and I released them quickly. I knew that Stephen was feeling the same awkward tension that I was, which comforted me a little. The figure reappeared on the screen. By now, the blue light had faded enough for me to see Stephen's eyes, nose, mouth, and ears. I could even make out some blinking lights on the wall behind him. Here, this is my wife, Stephen smiled, holding a framed picture up to the camera. In it, I saw a man and a woman. The man was Stephen, but he looked much, much younger in the photograph than he did on my screen. The woman next to him, Melinda, had long, wavy brunette hair, a pair of big eyes, and a smile that stretched from ear to ear. I remembered creating that picture. "And these are my children," he said, taking the picture of his wife away from the screen and instead holding up one of the two girls sitting in a pumpkin patch. "Maddie and Lil mean the world to me," he added quietly. "They're beautiful," I told him, wiping a tear from my eye. "Are you married, Jensen?" "Yeah, I just got married," I said, "a year ago today." "What's her name?" Jennifer Lane. Do you have any pictures? I already had the picture of Jennifer in my hand. Holding it up to the screen, I noticed Stephen's hazel eyes light up as he saw the picture. It didn't take a genius to know that he had seen it before. I took the frame away from the camera and set it back down below the monitor. Stephen and I spent an hour talking about our families, friends, and jobs. Neither one of us mentioned AI again. It was like talking to a real human. Well, mission accomplished, I thought as I walked home that night. I wanted an AI that would think just like a human, and I got one. The next day at work, I found Ian before I found Dr. Prescott. I was glad that I got a chance to talk to him because he had left the day before without talking to me. Ian, I said, grabbing his shoulder as he passed by me, could I have a word with you? Yeah, sure, he said with the same surprised look that he always had in his eyes. He followed me to the break lounge where we both sat on a faded red couch that faced the vending machines. Ian, how late did you stay last night? I asked. I was here until you said goodnight to Stephen, Ian answered. I left while you were staring at the blank computer screen. Oh, right. I cleared my throat and continued. So you remember the entire conversation that we had with each other? Yeah. What did you think? Even though I didn't clarify what I meant, Ian already knew. I think that he's going to have to go. That's what I was afraid of. I sighed, looking up at the dark television screen. I wanted to give Stephen one more chance for me to convince him that he wasn't real, but if things didn't go well, I'd have to delete the program from the Pioneer memory box. It wouldn't be a total loss. I backed up all of the codes on Dr. Prescott's computer. If I had to delete Stephen, then we'd just go back to the code and figure out what went wrong. I went to find Dr. Prescott while I booted up Stephen's program. It only took a couple of seconds for the screen to turn blue. As the blue screen faded away, I saw Stephen sitting in the chair on the computer monitor. He squinted at the camera and asked, "Jensen, are you there?" "I'm here, Stephen," I said. "Is something wrong?" he inquired. "No, why?" "You sound sad." "Well, there's a lot going on today." "You and I have a lot in common, Jensen. Are you busy, too?" "Not really, but I am sad." "I have the strange feeling that we're both sad for the same reason," I said. "Am I right, Stephen?" Stephen was quiet for a moment, but then he said, "Jensen, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but there are protocols here that need to be followed." "Yep, that's what I thought," I said, barely opening my mouth. "We didn't get to talk about this much yesterday, Stephen, but you're an artificial intelligence, and you think that you're a human. Actually, Jensen, you're the AI, and just the fact that you think you programmed me says that you could do permanent damage from this computer." "Well, at least we both have the same feelings about this," I whispered. "The question is, which of us is the real human?" "Actually, I had a chance to think about that." Stephen leaned forward in his chair. "An AI has to have access to a computer or hard drive to run properly. The real AI would use his or her own computer as a means of controlling the real person's computer." "Right," I nodded slowly. "So no matter which of us deletes the other, the real AI will be deleted and the real person will be okay." "That's right." Stephen and I looked into each other's eyes for a short time before I asked him, "How sure are you that you are the human?" He looked taken aback. "Well," he said, "up until yesterday when I met you, 100%. Now I'm a little iffy." I groaned. I was in the exact same boat. "It would be nice if we could stay friends," I told Stephen. He nodded. "It would. We have a lot in common. However, protocols are clear. We could both get fired for leaving the other here." "Dying won't be bad," I declared confidently. "What do you mean?" "I mean that at least if you're the AI, you won't even know that you died. I programmed you to record your entire life. When you die, You relive your life over and over again. Stephen grimaced and nodded. I did the same for you, he said. You won't relive the entire life, remember, just your real life. From the moment you were first activated by me. And you won't remember all of this already happened. You won't even know that you died. I nodded my head and noticed that my eyes were starting to water. I buried my hand inside the sleeve of my lab coat and wiped the tears away. So, which of us should delete the other? I will, Stephen said. I'll delete you. If, after I do this, you're still standing there, then that means that I was the real AI. If you don't remember this conversation, then you were the AI. Just do it, I said quickly, wiping my eyes again. Stephen nodded. Goodbye, Jensen, he whispered hoarsely. Goodbye, Stephen. Stephen broke eye contact with me and began typing away at his computer. The typing echoed through the speakers next to my screen. I turned around and saw Dr. Prescott and Ian practically pressing their noses up against the glass window in anticipation. As I turned back around to face the computer, I was shocked to find that Stephen was fading away. He was slowly getting replaced with the same blue screen that I saw when I first activated him. However, even though the video was fading, the audio kept growing louder and louder. The buttons on Stephen's keyboard tapped away at my brain, causing every last cell to vibrate violently. I couldn't take it anymore. I needed to move. I couldn't just sit here and listen as Stephen was destroying himself. I stood up so quickly that the blue rolling chair rolled all the way to the window of the observation room on the other side of the lab. Dr. Prescott and Ian were no longer sitting there. They were gone. I ran out of the lab. The moment I entered the hallway, I felt like someone started squeezing my lungs. Oh no, not again, I thought. It's another panic attack. I felt dizzy. Every direction I turned, I felt like there would be someone waiting there to grab me and take me somewhere far away where I'd never be seen again. Leave me alone, I screamed with the little air left in my chest. I didn't even know who I was screaming at. I just couldn't stand still and wait for someone to take me. I turned my head and realized that I was standing still outside of the small lab. I turned to the right and ran down the hall. I don't know where I was going. I didn't know where I thought I could go. I just couldn't think straight. I didn't stop running. I suppose I could have if I wanted to, but the thought of what would happen to me if... I stood still for any more than half a second frightened me to death. My breaths grew louder and louder as I ran down the dull gray hallway, which I had casually walked through so many times before. My head spun as I turned the corner and collided with Dr. Prescott. Jensen! Dr. Prescott exclaimed as the stack of papers she'd been carrying dumped out of her hands and spilled all over the hallway floor. She adjusted the thick black glasses, which had been knocked loose from the impact, and asked, Jensen, what's wrong? I'm so sorry. I panted heavily as Dr. Prescott held me by both my shoulders. I knelt down to help Dr. Prescott pick up the papers, but she tightened her grip on my arms and lifted me back up. Don't worry about the papers, dear, she insisted. That's all just some dumb pioneer mumbo-jumbo. What I want to know is why you're running through the labs with such energy. I opened my mouth to answer before I realized that I had absolutely no clue why I was running. Thanks for joining me this week for tonight's regularly scheduled Tales of Terror. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Tonight's program is being brought to you by Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly, your host, Otis Gyre. Got a scary tale of your own you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to us today at submissions@chillingtalesfordarknights.com for your chance to have me bring your sinister story to life. If you enjoyed what you heard and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review and a comment for your chance to be entered into a weekly prize drawing. Your feedback means a lot to us. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and bell notification icon to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. If you can never get enough spooky stories and can't wait until next week for more and haven't already, be sure to check out Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on YouTube for more than 500 free audio horror stories, or the Otis Gyre channel, my own digital home away from home, where you'll find dozens of previously released horror and sci-fi stories from yours truly. If you'd like to connect with or support me and CTFDN, visit the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights Facebook page or at their website, ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can support our programs by becoming a patron and get access to hundreds of stories, all ad-free. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with another pair of terrifying tales that'll keep you up all night.
Who needs sleep anyway?